I wish I could say it was that strategic. It was kind of a rant. I don't remember exactly what I said, but it was something like, you know, GitHub has dropped the ball on this and that, and why doesn't someone do something about it? And then at that point, Nat was like, well, you could like research those questions and answer it yourself if you want. And if you come up with an answer, you could build it at GitHub.
Machines are so fast and stores are so big that they give us plenty of latitude to screw things up.
The shell, which is the name we give to the command interpreter.
So the operator got a pair of tweezers and very carefully fished the moth out of the relay.
Because you've all read The Mythical Man Month.
And the best motivator in the world for programming is scratching your itch.
Developers, 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 developers.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sourcecraft Podcast. My name is Byung, and on this show, we talk with the people behind amazing dev tools and developer experience. Open source authors, maintainers, DevEx engineers inside forward-thinking companies, developer advocates and educators, founders of dev tool companies, anyone and everyone who brings joy and delight into our lives as programmers. We talk about their work, we talk about their lives, we talk about their vision of what lies ahead for the world of code. Stay tuned. Everyone, thanks for joining for another episode of the Sourcecraft Podcast. Today, I'm here with Devin Zugel. Devin is a crafter of code and words. She was the creator of GitHub Sponsors, taking that project from inception through launch and to the incredible success it's yielded today for open source authors. She's the host of a video series called Tools and Craft, where she interviews pioneers in the field of computer science. And you might also be familiar with her writings on her blog, where she talks about things ranging from supersonic planes to learning Spanish to the design of different cities, designing markets and incentive structures, and cryptocurrencies. So Devin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to this.
So, you know, to kick things off, what was it that first got you into the world of computers? How did you get into the world of code?
It was a pretty roundabout path. In high school, I thought I wanted to be a journalist. But then I worked on some old cars with my high school boyfriend at the time. And I realized that replacing the engine of a 67 Mustang was really fun. And so I decided to study mechanical engineering in college. And one of the requirements for a mechanical engineering degree was computer science, just like, you know, an intro CS class. And I really liked it. So I took another class, which was not part of my requirements. And I really liked that. And I took another class and I realized, I just wanted to study that instead. And the thing that really resonated with me was that when you're doing mechanical engineering and you're working on a car engine, each part, it costs money. And if you break it, you have to replace it. And so the like cost of making mistakes is way higher. Whereas with software, you can just rerun the code. And of course, there is software that you don't want to run poorly and, you know, you don't want to ruin data and all that stuff. But it's a different level of feedback loop and ability to just sort of churn. You just rerun the tests. If they fail, you change the code, you rerun the tests. And so that was really attractive to me because I really liked the speed of that feedback loop.
Yeah, that makes total sense. As a CS major in college, I always felt that the other engineering majors kind of looked down on us because, you know, we had it so easy and to the point where it didn't seem like real engineering. Like they were all kind of like planning ahead, you know, contingency planning for, you know, what could go wrong. And we were like, well, you know, if it doesn't compile, look at the code and recompile again and repeat, rinse, repeat until it works.
I think there's something to be said of that. But at the same time, why choose to do something hard when you could do something easy that is also valuable?
So. I know. Exactly. Cool. So did you like switch majors then, or did you just get into programming and you graduated with the ME degree and then went straight into software?
I switched majors. Yeah. Okay. I ended up taking so many CS classes, I didn't really have space for the ME classes anymore. So I switched majors, I think, in maybe the end of my sophomore year, something like that.
Nice. And after you graduated, give us like the whirlwind tour of your kind of professional career so far.
Yeah. So when I graduated, I joined as a software engineer at a company called Affirm. It's not a firm called Affirm. It's the company is called Affirm. Affirm does point of sale lending. And I joined because I was really interested in creating more economic access and opportunity for people, because I think a lot of people are locked out of our current financial systems. Mm-hmm. So that was what was really appealing to me about what Affirm was doing. And then I was only there for a year, though, because I kind of realized that the work I was doing was not something that I was like uniquely good at. And that's something I like to do things that a place where I can make a unique contribution. And while I thought the work that Affirm was doing was important, it just wasn't something that I felt like any other new grad engineer could kind of take my spot and mm-hmm. do at least as good of a job as I was doing. Mm-hmm. So I decided to leave and work on some projects that I felt sort of more of a calling to, or I thought I could make more of a contribution. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading a lot about cities and urban economics, which is a sort of different path that we haven't talked about that I sort of went in college as well.
Yeah.
And also that's when I started hosting the show that you mentioned, Tools and Crafts, about computing pioneers.
Yeah.
And I was kind of all over the place for a year or so. And I was also very involved in housing policy. It was kind of it was a very exploratory period for me. Yeah. I worked on a crypto company. And then when the Microsoft acquisition happened in June of 2018, or I think it was sometime in the summer, 2018.
This is of GitHub.
GitHub. Yeah, sorry. The Microsoft acquisition of GitHub happened. I had become friends with Nat Friedman, who ended up being the CEO, through some housing policy stuff that we worked on. And I sent him this like long email about things that I thought he could do as the CEO, and especially around like helping open source maintainers. And at that point, Nat sort of responded to my email and was like, "Those are interesting ideas. How about you come do them with us?" So just watch out who you send emails to, because you might walk right straight into a job.
Awesome.
And so then I was at GitHub for about 2.5, well, almost 3 years, working on tools for open source maintainers, which was sort of the beginning of sponsors. And there I was a product manager as opposed to a software engineer. But of mm-hmm. course, you know, having the software background, having contributed to open source in the past and that kind of thing really helped me, frame the work that I was doing.
Yeah. Do you remember what that email, like what did you pitch, you know, GitHub sponsors directly in that email, or, you know, what did that email contain?
I wish I could say it was that strategic. It was kind of a rant, I think. I don't remember exactly what I said, but it was something like, you know, GitHub has dropped the ball on this and that. And you know, as a user, mm-hmm. I want to see this happen. Like, why doesn't someone do something about it? and then at that point, Nat was like, "Well, you could like research those questions and answer it yourself if you want. And if you come up with an answer, you could build it at GitHub." And so I was like, "Oh, those are actually really interesting research questions. GitHub seems to be a really high leverage place to work on that." I think back to that part about like the contributions that I could uniquely make. I thought my background between sort of development economics and software and open source and community building was like a really interesting intersection that most people don't have. Most people have parts of those things, but not all of them at once.
Yeah.
And so I thought, man, like I have this like immense leverage point and also a lot of the background that I think someone would need to solve this problem, or at least make steps towards solving the problem. And so that's how I ended up joining GitHub.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's super awesome that he, you know, came back at you with like, okay, what are you going to do about it? I really think that, you know, maybe that's, you had sort of known him through the work that you did together in SF housing policy. But I feel like he's maybe the type of guy who would respond to cold emails as long as they're like thoughtful as well. Like I know certainly I would. And I think, you know, other people at SourceGraph would as well. I wish like more people just sent cold emails like that, pitching ideas and giving like thoughtful critique to people who you know are in various companies. I think they would be well received generally.
Yeah, I agree with that, with the caveat that I think that the people who, a lot of people do send those cold emails, and I think they're the ones who you like don't want to be sending the emails. And then there's a lot of really thoughtful people who are afraid of it. Yeah. Like, so I think there's basically, if you, yeah, there's a strong selection effect. And yeah. So if we lived in a world where, but basically if you want to send one of those emails to somebody, but then you think, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I need to learn more about the subject, or maybe they're not interested in hearing it, you're probably the one that they want to hear from.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that question go through your head, then you probably shouldn't send it. that's the heuristic, I would say. So, but yeah, I think there's a lot of really good ideas out there. And, you know, for sending those sorts of emails, the worst thing that can happen is they just don't respond to you. Like
yeah.
It's, and even in that case, you've still probably sharpened your thinking by writing it down. So I find it to be really, really useful to receive them. And I mean, I don't respond to every single email I get of that type anymore, just because a lot of people email me. When you work at a place like GitHub, there are a lot of people sending you emails with ideas. So sorry to everyone who I haven't responded to, but
yeah,
you know, you can't write an essay every few hours. I read them all and I think about them all, and they've definitely all contributed to my thinking.
Yeah, that's awesome. And again, yeah, the downside is you just don't get a response, which is, you know, shoot your shot, so to speak.
Right.
Cool. So at the time you joined GitHub, this was after the acquisition by Microsoft had been announced, but had the acquisition already been completed at that point? What was kind of the stage of the company?
I originally joined as an independent contractor, actually, as a researcher, not as a full-time employee. And I joined when the acquisition had not yet closed. So I think I joined in like August as a contractor, and then the acquisition closed in like November or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I joined as a full-time employee in December as a product manager. And in that period of time when I was a contractor, I was doing research, and it was a sort of like a 4 to 6 month contract or something. And the plan was like, if I don't come up with something that I want to work on, or something that Nat doesn't want to fund, or whatever, then, you know, we'll be like, nice working with you, let's move on. But then if I did come up with something that we wanted to build, then I would like follow through and build a team around it. And that's what ended up happening.
Okay, interesting. So was it kind of like an open-ended research mandate, like starting from the ideas that you mentioned in those emails, and just, you know, go and explore some of these ideas and see if any of these threads lead to something that we think is promising?
Yeah, exactly. It was totally open-ended. I mean, I sort of set the bounds for myself, saying, hey, the main thing I want to do is I see that maintainers of open source projects are sort of like the keystone species of the entire open source ecosystem. There aren't that many of them, so they're easy to overlook, but actually they're like deeply important. And if they're not doing well, like the whole ecosystem's not going to do well. And so my research question was like, how can we help these people do better? And like help give them resources so that they can really thrive on the platform, as opposed to what I saw at the time was like, they were kind of getting neglected. But within that range, it was pretty open-ended. And I think also, honestly, if I had come out of left field with a completely different proposal, I also sense that if it was good, Nat still would have accepted it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Can you describe what that research period was like? Like, do you remember what ideas you considered, you pursued, maybe kind of, you know, took half the way, but then decided, you know, weren't worth continuing? Like, what was the road to eventually getting to GitHub sponsors?
Yeah, it was pretty winding, and it was pretty unstructured for most of the time, which was a little scary, actually, because like, I didn't really know where it was going to end up. But that is also the point of doing research, is you like start with a question and you don't know what the answer is. So
yeah.
The most important thing I did was, before I like even had any hypotheses or anything like that, I just talked to a ton of maintainers and open source contributors and open source consumers, because while I had programmed for a little while before that, and I had used open source and contributed to open source myself, mm-hmm. you know, my experience was really limited. I had, at that time, I was primarily programming in Ruby and TypeScript, which is a small portion of the overall programming world. And I had only, you know, interacted personally with a few open source maintainers, and I didn't want to overgeneralize just based off of those experiences. Those experiences were super formative, of course, but I also wanted to like make sure I understood the rest of the world. And so I just talked with like hundreds of people and asked them like, what are your problems? What does your typical day look like? How did you decide to do what you want to do? That kind of thing. What do you wish GitHub would build? Got a huge range of answers. And then from there, I took the ones that I thought were personally most interesting. So like, the, you know, from those answers that there's probably 1,000 different directions I could have gone. But I went down the route where I was like, I have a good feeling about this direction. And I feel like I can solve mm-hmm. some of these problems. And in particular, that was around funding. And so I started asking people like, how do you fund your work? How do you like think about that? What sorts of, mm-hmm. what's like the smallest thing that GitHub could do to help you like make more money, assuming you want to make more money? And like there were a few maintainers said something like, I just wish that like GitHub would like formalize the fact that it's like okay for us to ask for money, because in 2018, that was when, in 2018, almost everyone who was getting any sort of like sponsorships for their projects, they just put it in their README saying like, hey, you can sponsor me. Here's a button. And there were a lot of maintainers who were like, not sure if that was kosher. Like they didn't know if that was like against GitHub's terms of service or something like that. And then also just like socially, it wasn't that typical at the time. And so I realized like, oh man, we need to just like signal that we're okay with this. Like not, this is like a blessed path if you want to go down it. And so the very first thing that my team built was the sponsor button. This is actually before GitHub sponsors existed. It was basically what we did was we built this button at the top of repos. You've probably seen that little pink heart. It was like one of the first colored buttons on the page too, which I had like bright pink, which I don't think there's ever been hot pink on GitHub before. I was very excited about that. And you press that button and it shows you links to places that people might receive funding, like Patreon, Open Collective, etc. And there was like a huge outpouring of people being like, oh my gosh, GitHub's cool with this. Great. It created this like common knowledge socially that like, if GitHub's okay with it, then like I can do it. And I have like backing, and it just kind of blessed it, which I was like really happy that we were able to play that role.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when did that button ship?
I think the button shipped in February of 2019. So like I might have the exact month wrong, but the chronology is something like I joined like December 15th of 2018. Holidays hit. I didn't have like any team like or anything like that. So, and then I came back in January and I like wrote this blog post called Let's Talk About Open Source Sustainability. Yeah. And that like had a really positive response. And we did like a survey in that. And then based off of that, because it was sort of like proof, I basically was using that as like evidence of all of the research I had done, like quantitative. And then it got the whole company behind it. And so then by February, I put together a small team of engineers and designers, and myself, maybe like 5 people or something. Again, I'm so bad with numbers. and then we shipped the very first, that button by either like late February or early March.
That's awesome. That's super.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go for it.
I was just gonna say that seems super fast. So like the research period, that was like the contracting phase, that was fall through the winter. And then you joined full time in, December, the holidays happen. And then in 2 months you had, the button out, you'd gotten it out the door.
Yeah. For me, I think momentum is so important. Like,
yeah,
if you don't instantly get a team thinking like, yeah, we build stuff together, then you just kind of like laze about and don't do anything. And yeah. I mean, I in particular, I'm the type of person who will just like research something until I'm dead and never make any progress whatsoever. And so like to adjust for that, I try to do the opposite. Like, because I know I have that tendency, I like push myself to build things before I feel like I fully understand the problem.
Yeah.
Because you can always, like in most cases, you can unship things if they don't work.
Right.
And
right.
you'll learn a lot of stuff once you've shipped it. Now, I do think like if we had shipped like full on GitHub sponsors, that would have been hard to unship because now there's like, there would be people who are making money from it. So like there are certain things that are like a one way ratchet, but for the most part, like something like that button, you know, we could have changed it. We could have, if it didn't work, it could have gone a totally different direction and it's fine.
Yeah. So all the button did was take them to whatever the maintainer author was linking to previously in their README. Is that right? Like GitHub at this point wasn't collecting payments or anything like that.
That's right. Yeah. Like basically the what the button did was it searched your repository for a funding.yml file. I think there might've been some other formats we supported too.
Oh,
and
okay.
then from that file, it like sort of pulled it and we wanted it to be structured so it could be also used for other forms as well.
Yeah.
And, or you could like fork it or you can open a pull request to say like, hey, you should add Open Collective or whatever.
Yeah.
We like everything to be like version controlled if possible in GitHub. And then it pulls from that file and like generates the button based off of that. And if you don't have the file, you don't have a button.
So where did things go from there? You got the button out. People were excited. What was the evolution of the product? Yeah, at what point did you turn it into like a full-fledged like feature and product area?
So with that button, we saw like before the button, we had done a survey that sort of showed that a lot of maintainers thought that GitHub's lack of like funding options were really a problem. And so that's mm-hmm. what like was enough evidence to get to the button. And then the mm-hmm. button saw like massive uptick and like a ton of maintainers had this like outpouring of, oh my gosh, GitHub is finally like doing something on this. We're so happy. And so then that was like enough evidence to do the next thing. Like you need to build these like sort of like stepping stones of evidence to get to a big investment of something like sponsors.
Right.
Or at least you don't have to, but I like to work that way so that you don't find yourself, you know, 6 months down the road, realizing like, oh, dang, we just like spent half a year building something no one wants.
Yeah.
So the button gave us that confidence. And so we said like, hey, like, let's make this super easy for people to do. Because like a lot of the problems that I had heard in my research was that just like setting up a way to receive money was difficult. It was a lot of paperwork. It was time consuming. Or, you know, with Patreon made it pretty straightforward. But it wasn't really made for programmers, and it wasn't something that was like co-located with your code. And you had to like send someone fully off the page and like they had to create a new account and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we thought, yeah, we can make that, like, we already have people's identities like here. We already know what, you know, software they use and stuff like that. Many of them already have a credit card on file. So like, let's make this like super frictionless. And that's where we built sponsors. And then, so I believe we started building it probably in February, like late February. I think we like started building it when we had put the button out for beta or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact chronology. Let's just say start of March. And then we shipped the very first beta version of GitHub Sponsors with like payments and basic identity verification and stuff like that on May 23rd.
Got it. And while you were building it, were there any folks who were like, well, why are we building this? You know, there's already like things like Patreon, there's other ways that people are already doing this. Doesn't really contribute anything new. I feel like, you know, whenever you're building something new, there's a lot of people who don't fully grok the vision. They compare it to other things that are similar but not quite the same. as a way to kind of say like, well, you know, this already exists, so we don't need to build it. Did you encounter any sort of resistance like that at all?
I didn't hear too much of that within GitHub, but that was partially because like we were somewhat in, I don't know, like not exactly stealth mode. We weren't secretive, but we just didn't include like the entire company on our decision-making process. Like the executive team was very much aware, and like anyone who was paying attention to our repo in the company, like would have seen it, but we didn't, you know, ask everyone in the whole, you know, is it, what, two or 3,000 person company, we didn't go around like asking everyone what they thought. So probably there were people who, if they had known we were doing it, they would have given that feedback. But they just weren't really involved in the process.
Got it. Cool. Yeah. I've it seems to be, a fairly common pattern, especially inside large companies. When you want to spin up a new project, you kind of, isolate it from the rest of the organization and give it kind of room and space to maybe reach that like first proof point or first MVP.
Yeah, stage. it's so important. If you give everybody a veto power, then and even if it's like an implicit one where, you know, formally they don't get to decide, but for some reason their voice is in the mix, like nothing will happen at all. and you just sometimes you need to let people just move forward, especially if it's not like a harmful decision. So, I mean, it's tricky because there are some people who probably should have veto power, you know, and like, for example, GitHub's lawyers 100% had veto power, right? Because we had, or in the sense of like, if we were doing something illegal, they should be like, you can't do that. That's illegal. So you do need to include them in the process, but, you can't include every single, you know, designer and engineer who has their own opinion about how it's going to turn out, which, you know, there's a lot of things that I wasn't included in that other teams were working on. And, you know, my opinion is obviously the most important one. So they really screwed up by not including me, but
I think it's, that balance is so tricky to get right. Cause obviously you don't want to be concerned about everything. The whole point of an org structure is to, I guess, like isolate concerns and enable people to focus on the things that they're best at. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, you could articulate some reason that someone somewhere should care about this thing. And if you don't get the like abstraction boundaries right, you can easily get into this mode where you're just not doing anything because there's always like a reason to not do something. There's always a million reasons to not do something.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so I answered your question in a meta way, like organizationally. I can also answer it in like a more direct, like object way, where around like the particular critique. I think it's actually very true that the first version of GitHub sponsors was not, you know, completely different from anything that was out there. It had some different choices that we made, and you know, it's not like a complete copycat either, but. Mm-hmm. It's solving a similar problem to what was out there. But I think that there's something very different about something being like co-located with the code versus something like a Patreon, which you have to go like off onto a completely different page.
Totally.
And it sounds like a trivial difference, but like one of the things that you end up getting, if you think about the structure of it, if you have to share a link to your Patreon for someone to fund you, that's going to, basically, what's the word? It's going to privilege people who have like really big Twitter followings, or are just like generally very active on social media, compared to if the sponsorship opportunity is next to the code where you're actually looking at it. So you're like looking at the documentation, you're looking at the README, you're digging through the implementation of a particular function, and you have like a sponsorship button right there. If it's not right there, then there's this like disconnect from the value that's actually created and the like distribution to get access to people who will fund you. And that doesn't mean that like tweeting about your Patreon link is a bad thing. It just means that like there's an entire group of people who you know, quote unquote, deserve funding, who are doing great work, but they just don't tweet that much. And so they don't get that access. And I think that those dynamics, like, while they're small, they actually add up a lot and result in like certain types of projects getting funded and other types of projects not getting funded.
Yeah, totally. There's always, you know, some correlation, but also a bit of a disconnect between folks who are better at, you know, marketing their projects or their personal brand and folks who, you know, code just gets used everywhere just because it, you know, taps into a very common piece of functionality that a lot of people need.
Totally. And I also can't underscore the importance of like sort of social norms. So by making this a blessed path within GitHub, like GitHub, whether it likes it or not, like sets a lot of the norms of open source communities. Like, you know, everyone's going to have a readme. The pull requests are just like a thing that almost every open source project does now. Like the list goes on and on. And so if it's a choice, GitHub doesn't have an opinion that like every project should be funded. You know, a lot of people want to just do it for fun and that's awesome. But for those who do want to be funded, we don't want them to be like, oh man, are people going to hate us if we ask for money? Like, are people going to hate me if I ask for myself to be able to pay the rent? We want to make it so that like, if you want to do it, it doesn't become this like social issue where you have to like sort of get the guts up to do it. Just let's get rid of that obstacle, get rid of the stigma, and bring people in. So Those were our two biggest goals initially, were to like co-locate the sponsorships with the actual value being created and to also remove the social stigma. Actually, I guess the third goal is also just like reduce friction, because creating a new account on Patreon just to sponsor someone is hard.
Yeah, totally. And it seems obvious to say these things in retrospect now that, you know, GitHub sponsors is a thing. It's obviously successful and is funding a lot of open source developers. But, you know, we're saying this with all like the benefit of hindsight here. On the other side of things, there's so many kind of open variables that it's hard to compare kind of like the point of view like pre-launch versus post-launch, I guess, post-success.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So with respect to launching sponsors itself and getting the payments infrastructure stood up, were there any sort of complexities there? Like, you know, what goes into, you know, receiving money on the internet these days?
Well, there, one of the big things that we had a challenge with was like, We had this thing called the GitHub Sponsors Matching Fund, which basically said for your first year in the program, you can we'll match like dollar for dollar the first $5,000 that you make, and that's a lot of money, you know, and so we ended up having to put in place much stricter like identity verification and just like control, like fraud controls in place from day one than we would have had to if we were just sort of enabling people to sponsor each other, and because we were basically giving out free money on the internet, which I think was worth it because it did jumpstart the community and like got a lot of people interested in doing it. And like there were a lot of people who ended up emailing me later saying, hey, you know, those first few months that I was starting my sponsorship, I didn't think I was going to be able to quit my job because, you know, at the beginning you're ramping up, you're not making enough money, but because of the matching fund, I was actually able to quit my job much sooner. That ramp up happened really quickly. And then once I got to a stable state where I was making like $5,000-$10,000 a month just on my own, you know, the matching fund had run out, but it like helped me get up to that point. So I'm really glad we did it, but it meant that it was like really hard from day one because we needed to make sure that people didn't like create multiple accounts and stuff like that to try to make more of the matching fund. And you know, it definitely, I would definitely say it slowed down other parts of the product development because we were spending so much time trying to clamp down and make sure that fraud didn't get through. And we did solve that problem basically. I mean, fraud is always, of course, an ongoing problem. But we built a very robust system in place and it works pretty well, but it was a huge amount of work. And in some days I think like, oh, I kind of wish that we had actually spent that like iterating on the product more as opposed to doing that. So that was definitely very difficult.
Yeah. Tell us more about the iterations of the product. So you launched it. Was it like an overnight success from the get-go? Because you know everyone's like GitHub sponsorship, like this clicks, or were the things that you had to do to kind of boost adoption and increase the kind of growth rate as you went along?
It was pretty overnight. Like people, I mean, we did a lot of things to improve it down the road, but people instantly got it, which I think we had really good timing because I think if we had done it even just like 2 or 3 years earlier, people would not have gotten it. That's my guess. Of course, hard to know the counterfactual. But I think by the time we launched it in May of 2019, there had been this sort of like growing understanding of like content, and of which, you know, code is a type of content on the internet. Can't all just be free. We can't just support, like, I feel like my youth and like young adulthood was sort of marked by, you know, the idea like everything on the internet can just be free, you know, we can just like copy everything infinitely. Bits are easy to copy, so like, you know, you wouldn't download a car, but you know, you would definitely download like, you know, Tron or whatever. And the problem is that like it's true that bits are easy to download, but you still need to pay for the people producing it. And the old models that we had when distribution was sort of the bottleneck allowed for creators of like knowledge goods to get paid. Like, you know, when things were physically on CDs, they weren't actually making, like, if you think about it, they weren't actually making money from the music. They were making money from the fact that they're selling CDs. And then it happens to like have the music on it. The music is what makes it valuable. But as soon as the music turns into an MP3, like, you're not paying for it anymore.
Yeah.
And so what we needed to do was create something kind of like how, you know, Spotify got rid of piracy, or much of piracy, because they made it like so convenient to pay for music. And that's what really people wanted. So anyway, that was a huge tangent, but the core thing is I think people were starting to recognize you need to like support the creators. Otherwise that content is like not going to exist, or it's just not going to be that good.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a growing awareness, and, you know, value creation and value capture are two different things and they ought to go hand in hand, but very much often it's the case that they're very separate, and people who are good at the former aren't necessarily good at coming up with ways to do the latter. And so, you know, platforms like GitHub sponsors kind of enable easier value capture mechanisms. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've always appreciated about you is you kind of have this dual appreciation of both software and code and, you know, that world, and also economics and understanding, you know, markets and incentives and things like that.
I try to, at least. Well, they're complicated, but we did end up having to iterate on one thing, which we kind of knew that we had not solved this problem when we first launched. So when we first launched, GitHub sponsors was really only enabling individuals to sponsor other individuals. But when you think about open source, like, a lot of the best open source projects are groups of people who are creating it, and like groups of people who are using it, like companies.
Yeah.
And we like completely did not solve that problem at all from day one. And that was intentional, because that's a much harder problem to solve. And we weren't even sure if we could solve the simpler problem yet. So we launched the individual to individual sponsorship. And once we sort of tamped that down and got it working really well and like improved our operational quality, we then started thinking like, okay, how would we generalize this so that groups of people can receive funds? And if you think of it as like a 2x2 matrix, there's like, you know, four quadrants. There's individuals to individuals, individuals to groups, groups to individuals, and groups to groups. Mm-hmm. And so we started like, basically our roadmap was to just like fill out that quadrant over time.
Yeah.
And that, like, as soon as you start dealing with groups, it becomes more challenging because you have to do things like, you know, who pays the tax burden? Is there like a legal entity? Like, where does the liability lie? Stuff like that. And basically we wanted to help the maintainers solve those problems as opposed to creating more problems for them by just being like, here's money. Now you guys like fight amongst yourselves to like figure out where it goes. So that was like, we did, after the initial launch, then our next step was to like iterate to be like, okay, how do we make this work for groups?
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, what went into that? Was it, you know, more research and user conversations? How did you kind of hone in on the right system or, you know, mechanism for enabling group funding?
Initially, I started by talking to more maintainers and sort of asking them, like, especially maintainers who had gone through the process themselves of receiving funds on behalf of their group. Asking them like, what pitfalls did you run into? What sorts of things? And like, you know, I heard some pretty sad stories, honestly, of maintainers who were like, I just decided to like get all the money to my personal bank account. And then I like sent it out and then to the other people on my team. And then like a year later, when I had to pay taxes, I realized I had to pay taxes for everybody, stuff like that.
Wow.
Which is not good, you know.
Yeah.
Like some of them that ended sucks. Up paying more taxes that than they themselves had like earned. And
oh my goodness.
Like technically, because it's income from the other people, what should be happening is those people should be paying taxes. But like it looks like this person has received all of these funds. Like let's say, just to make the math easy, let's say you have 10 people on your team and you receive $1 million to your account, and then you like send 100K to each of the other 9 people.
Yeah.
You're now like, from the IRS's perspective, it like looks like, unless you specifically account for this, it looks like you've made $1 million. So, yeah. So anyway, I heard stories like that. But then I kind of candidly, I realized like most maintainers are just not well educated on these things. And I'm going to have to go like get educated and build it into the product for them.
Yeah.
So that they don't make those mistakes. And to be totally fair, if I were them, I would have made the same mistakes too. The way I see GitHub sponsors is taking that kind of stuff off of the shoulders of maintainers so they can just do what they're good at. Like open source maintainers shouldn't have to be like tax attorneys. You know, they shouldn't have to like know all this stuff. They should just be able to build really great software for people. So I ended up talking to a bunch of lawyers and, you know, GitHub does not give legal advice to anybody, like any users. But we figured, like, how can we build like nudges into the product to help people like think about the types of questions that they need to be aware of? Or how do we make it easy for you to just ignore those problems entirely? So like one of the things we did to try to solve that problem was we encouraged everybody to get a like legal entity to receive funds to. So that that legal entity would be the one like liable for the taxes, not the people themselves. And like we were really lucky to partner with Open Collective, which is a really, really cool company that offers a bunch of things. But to me, one of the coolest things they offer is the ability to have like a parent organization that is already incorporated, usually as a nonprofit. And you just join in as sort of like a project within that organization.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to do any additional paperwork really to, you know, get a Delaware incorporation or get a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And it just like handles that for you, and they handle a lot of the accounting and so on. And so anyway, we like nudged people towards those sorts of things to be like, hey, like this actually is really helpful. So you don't run into these issues down the line.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that there is this split, I think in I guess the economy between the act of creation, which is, you know, exercising your creative facilities to produce something that other people want, that's like new and valuable and interesting. And then the other side of it is kind of like the bean counting side of it, which is, you know, figuring out how to capture some of that value, but then all the different rules and regulations with respect to, you know, taxes and how you can allocate things. And it just seems that like, this is a very different, they exercise very different parts of the brain. And if you're good at one, chances are you find the other part just uninteresting. Like people who love like creating stuff, generally speaking, I think they don't like, you know, the accounting and the navigating the rules part. And then there's people who are like really good at, you know, the kind of accounting part of it. And oftentimes they don't specialize as much in the act of creation. And it just seems like, I don't know, sometimes it seems like the economy is set up in a way where like it kind of favors the people who just like spend all this time like reading up on like rules and regulations. And it, like, why can't we live in a world where like anyone who creates something of value that other people want can just like, you know, sell it and get paid for it? I know it's easier said than done, but
yeah, no, it's something I think about a lot. And like a big theme I would say in my career has been like, how can you build systems that like minimize the amount that creators have to think about those things? While also, you know, being compliant with laws or, you know, morally, like not creating ethical issues either. Cause like, so I totally agree with the sentiment, what you're saying. And I feel that really strongly, like day to day, the amount of like paperwork that one has to do to just do anything valuable in the world is like just too damn high. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I also understand that most of those things get into place because there's like someone somewhere who like thought it would protect somebody, and they might have even been right when they did it, but then like down the road conditions change and it's not as valuable anymore. I don't know what the overall solution is. I think a big part of the problem though is that people who put rules in place almost never bear the costs themselves. So it's like cheap for them to add laws or cheap for them to add hoops that you have to jump through. And like, yeah, sure, they might be well-meaning, but they're not really thinking about like what the downsides are. So like, for example, this is a bit of a rabbit hole, so I'll keep myself from going too deep down it, but
no worries. I've been
reading a lot about like business and labor law in Central America recently, and which I know seems like a totally random thing, but there's a connection, I promise. And there's like in Honduras, for example, I don't remember every single detail, so don't quote this, but like basically to start a business, you have to like get it registered. And it's expensive to do this. Like people in Honduras don't have that much money. So it's hard. It's basically a regressive tax on anyone who doesn't have that much money but wants to start a business. Yeah. And so the vast majority of people in Honduras and a lot of other countries in the world basically like have to start their business illegally if they want to, you know, sell baleadas or something like that. Yeah. And so they're just like, you know, sitting on the side of the road with their illegal business, trying to just like, you know, serve people yummy food and feed their own family. And like, but they're like inherently breaking the law just because they can't afford to pay this fee. Or like also, you know, in Honduras, it's a completely centralized government or highly centralized government. So to get a lot of different types of permits, you have to go to Tegucigalpa, which is the capital. And that's like pretty far away for some people. You know, they have to get on like a 9-hour bus ride or something. And so when you put these things, like the reason those like registrations exist is to, you know, protect people, to make sure that the government has visibility and can like tax people. And, you know, there's valid reasons to want this. But if you don't think about like, well, what is the counterfactual? Like, what are you stopping from existing because this thing is in place? And sometimes it might be worth it. You know, like I am very happy that, you know, I'm very happy that every like doctor I go to is actually licensed and stuff like that. And there's some people who are not going to be doctors because they can't get a license. And I'm kind of fine with that because I don't want someone who doesn't know what they're doing, like operating on me. I think we don't think enough about the trade-offs there. And a lot of regulations are much more about like minimizing harm as opposed to balancing harm with potential and opportunity.
Right.
So anyway, that's a bit of like a political rant, but I think it's a big problem. And we somehow need to impose costs on people who add every time someone adds a hoop that someone has to jump through, they themselves should like feel the cost of that, as opposed to just being like, I'm such a good person. I protected like one person from, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's a balancing act. You're absolutely right. And oftentimes the person doing the balancing is like, can't see half the scale or I don't know if that's the right analogy, but like, yeah, the costs are invisible to them. And so they don't do a good job of striking the right balance.
Yeah. And it's even worse than that, actually, because if you're like a lawmaker or politician or whatever, like, and something bad does happen, like, you might get in trouble for that. Whereas when something good happens, you rarely, like, people rarely get, I'm sure there's someone in Congress somewhere who like stopped some like regulation from being made a law, who, and now there's like some business that exists because that person like stopped that regulation. That's like great. But then you have things like, you know, I live in Miami, like the Miami building collapse that happened a few weeks ago.
Oh yeah. Like, that's crazy.
You know, there's something like, there's someone whose head is on a chopping block right now because, you know, they didn't, you know, check the regulations enough. So the incentives are very strongly towards being more careful and like stopping bad things from happening and making sure no bad thing can happen. But like, you have to think of it for people who are familiar with like machine learning, you have to like balance your false positives with your false negatives. You're never going to have zero of either one. And like, I think as a society, we've focused like way too much on like stopping false positives.
Yeah. And this kind of gets back to one of the themes that you like to I think, you know, discuss a lot, which is incentive design. Like, if you look at the incentives at play here, or like the game that's being played, I like to think in terms of like, you know, what games are different people playing? Like, if you're in the game of being, you know, a business, you get like points for providing value to people. Whereas if you're if you're a politician, then it's like you get negative points for, you know, when shit hits the fan, but you don't necessarily get positive points when, you know, nothing goes wrong. Cause then people are like, oh yeah, this is normal. Like, why would we give you bonus points for just keeping things, you know, running?
Yeah, I mean, actually, another Miami example that is maybe actually a little contentious, but I think an interesting counterbalance here is the mayor of Miami, his name is Francis Suarez. He is also a lawyer who specializes in corporate and real estate transactions. And what that means, I mean, I don't know the guy personally, so I can't say that this is what's going through his head. But it, like, if you look at it from the outside, his incentives as a mayor to like allow for more real estate to happen, more building and more development in Miami, it's like pretty well aligned with his like personal financial incentives as a lawyer to be like, let's like build more houses here and, or build more condos or whatever, so people have places to live. Versus like, you know, if he didn't have that, his incentives would be slightly less aligned. Now you could certainly also say like, you could see a version of that that is quite corrupt. Like, you know, he gives his clients, you know, permits or something like that, and doesn't give other clients permits, so they can get screwed up really quickly too. I wonder, like, what if, I don't know, like, what if we gave a mayor's like equity in a city? I don't know what that would look like, but and say like, hey, like, if you make the city prosperous and happy, like, you will make more money also. I'm sure there's a lot of problems with that as well. I'm not saying that it's like the solution to all of our problems. But I think it's at least worth exploring, like, what could that look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thought. And I was reading into this the other day. If you look at, like, the model of cities that we have in the U.S., I think originally they were called, like, corporations. Like, in the incorporation of a city, you kind of turning it into this corporation of sorts. But obviously, you know, with very different from, you know, typical corporation whose job is it is to sell goods and services. But I think there's something to that. And it's always tough because it's like, okay, is this person promoting this thing because they're invested in it and it's because, it's in their selfish interest? Or did they, you know, put money and invest in that thing because, you know, they're putting their money where their mouth is and you know, this is actually consistent. And, you know, I don't rightly know, you know, what the distinction, how to detect which is which myself, because the former is like a lot of, you know, sounds like corruption. And the latter is more like, okay, this person is just pushing this thing that they truly believe in multiple fashions. It's kind of like the same thing with, you know, there's a lot of politicians who are worried about, you know, climate change. And then you look at their investments and they're invested in like, you know, green technology or whatever. And then of course their critics will be like, well, you know, they're just promoting this because it favors their wallet. But then on the flip side, it's like, well, maybe they just believe that this is a serious issue. And so they're invested in it and they want to push it as a matter of public policy. So I don't know.
I think the best is when both things are true. Like I am a big believer that like you should put your money where you also think that like the world should go. Mm. And so like, I think both things can be true and that's healthy. Like imagine if you had a world where like the president or something thought that it was like really important to save the planet, but then also like they specifically didn't want to invest in any of the things that would save the planet because they didn't want to look like they had a conflict of interest.
That's weird.
So they put all their money into like oil or something. It's like, that doesn't seem right either. I think living in a world where all the incentives and sort of the ethics point the same way is like the best kind of world to live in.
Yeah.
And like, I think this is one of the reasons why Silicon Valley is in so many ways like a really strong engine for economic growth is and for people's personal growth. Like my experience of living in San Francisco, I've lived there my whole life up until a few months ago. My experience was always like people would always help me and constantly be kind of coming out of the woodwork to like offer me resources, offer me opportunities that, and I'm always like, why are you doing this? Like, this isn't good. Like, this isn't helping you at all. You know, maybe you're just a nice person. That's great. And something that's sort of sunk in over the past few years is realizing these things, it's a small community where anyone at any point could end up doing really well. They could end up doing something really impressive. So by being really kind to everybody early on in their career, you never know which of those people is going to go on to do something amazing and like bring you along with them. And so it's like this healthy thing. I mean, I think you could have a cynical take of like, oh, people are only nice to you because they think, you know, they might be able to invest in you in the future. But like, I don't know. I think it's good for them to like care about what you're doing just on a personal level, but then also have like an economic incentive. It seems just very healthy for people to do well. One last metaphor. I know we've gone down a rabbit hole, but like, it's sort of like how in, you know, a married couple like has very strong incentive to help each other, partially because they love each other and also partially because like their financial futures are tied together and it leads them to like prioritize each other. I think it's like having a lot more of those sorts of social bonds where when you do well, I do well is like, makes for a really, really healthy community and a really healthy society.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there's a lot to be said for long-term alignment of mutual interest. I think in a lot of cases like that long-term pursuit of your personal interests actually brings you into alignment with other people because I think you can accomplish a lot more things when you're doing it with other people, you know, rather than alone. And so oftentimes I think we think like self-interest and like general interest are in this kind of like weird conflict, but I really think more and more so it's like short-term self-interest runs into conflict with the general interest. But if you think long-term enough, then that actually, you know, causes you to act in kind of like virtuous and collaborative ways.
Totally. Yeah. Anyways. It's like if your neighbor asks you to like take care of their dog or something, let's say you both have dogs or, you know, plants or something, you know, maybe tomorrow you don't want to take care of the dog, but you're going to have to go on a trip at some point too. And so it's like, you do this favor, you don't know quite when you're going to go on your next trip, but like, it just turns into this like back and forth exchange. And there's no like total counter, but it's just this like general sense of like, yeah, like we're all slightly indebted to each other. We've all helped each other get to where we are, you know? And like at the end of the day, you don't have to pay for a kennel. So
yeah, totally. All right, so we're almost out of time. Before I let you go, I want to hear about two things. One is, you know, you've left GitHub now, and what are you up to next? But before we get to that, can I get you to kind of speculate on the future of GitHub sponsors and, you know, funding the open source ecosystem in general? Like, what do you think is going to happen in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think, I think there's a lot of directions sponsors could go. Really it's still in its infancy. I think what we built was really just these like building blocks of sort of financial relationships between people on the platform. And which can, I think, be used in a lot of different ways. I think what I would love to see the company and the team think about is like how to use those building blocks to enable a wide range of business models for software. So right now, like, there's really four primary modes for paying for software. There's software as a service, SaaS, which is like, you know, what a lot of these unicorn tech companies are doing. There's like licensing, which is not quite as popular, but it used to be like really popular, and that's how Microsoft made its money in like the 90s, and it's still used sometimes. There's ads, that's like how Google's funded. And then there's like free and voluntary through open source. I'm sure there's other ways to pay for software too besides those, but those are, I think, like the big four. But unfortunately, like, those don't work for every type of software. Like, they work great for certain things. And like free open source works great for certain things. And like, you're going to get a lot of awesome things. But I think there's other types of software infrastructure that are really hard for people to work on long-term, if they're not making any money. You know, for example, like the Heartbleed bug that happened, I don't know, a decade ago now. There are very few people who like wake up every morning and think like, I'm going to make sure that this core part of the internet, you know, is well-maintained and doesn't have vulnerabilities. It's just not on the top of like most people's minds. It's not the thing that like when someone has their winter vacation or whatever, they're going to like spend their time contributing to that. And even if they did, like, that sort of fun short-termism, I don't think is going to result in the like long-term maintenance that we need. And so we, like, in my opinion, we need to like pay these people, and we need to find business models that will support that. Luckily, Heartbleed does get funding. The HTTP protocol like does get funding now because of that crisis that happened. But there's other things like that we're probably not aware of that need to get funded. So anyways, I think like finding more business models that will solve for more of those problems is really crucial, because right now there's like entire gaps of things that just don't get funded, and as a result don't really happen, or they happen in like a volunteer firefighter kind of way. As opposed to like a professionalized, like, this is important infrastructure that, you know, our entire society is built on kind of way.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts or like guesses as to what those new business models might be?
I think one of the things I was exploring right before I left GitHub, was the idea of like making it easier to set up enterprise licensing agreements. Yeah, they're called ELAs. It wasn't something that I didn't solve the problem. I don't quite know how to do it from like a product perspective. But right now, ELAs, for those who aren't familiar, it's like they come in a lot of different flavors. But the basic idea is that like someone who works on a particular piece of software can say, you pay me on retainer, basically. And you pay me, let's just say, $50,000 a year. And if you that gives you access to like, you can have like three incidents this year where I'll come and help you at any time, or I'll give like workshops or whatever. Like, you get some chunk of my time in some way that you want, or like support hours or something. And if you don't use it, then you still pay me. And if you do use it, then you still pay me. And if you go above, then you pay me more. It's like basically a retainer, like the way you might have a retainer for a lawyer. And right now those are all done pretty custom and bespoke. And I think one of the things that GitHub could do is like sort of lower the bar of like legal knowledge and sort of business knowledge that you would need to be able to set up an ELA. I don't think that would solve for every single type of software that needs to get funded, to be clear. But I think it's like another one of those tools to add to the tool belt to like make it easier to start these types of businesses.
Yeah, it, kind of the same way that there's like a couple standard open source licenses now that everyone uses. Would you be thinking like a couple standard ELA templates that people could use?
Right, exactly. And like I was sort of exploring, like, could it be, could we give a template where they sort of pick and choose their favorites and, you know, and then we could also recommend like a price. This is where it gets a little dicier because like the maintainer does have more information about what they are offering and who they are and what the project is and who their customers are and stuff. But like, maybe is there some way we could like suggest what the price should be? Because like one thing I've noticed is that open source maintainers usually do not know how to price their time. They price it way too low. Like there's one person in who had a sponsorship profile who was like one of the most famous developers in the world, like very technically amazing. And this guy was like offering, he was saying something like, if your company sponsors me for $100 a month, you'll get 15 hours or like, let's say 20 hours to make it easy, like 20 hours of my support time per month. And I'm like, honey, do the math. Like,
it's less than like minimum wage.
Yeah, it's significantly less than minimum wage. And you're like extremely talented person who, you know, you could easily be making like $300 an hour or more for the expertise that you have. Like, don't do $5 an hour. So anyway, we wanted to like kind of nudge people and be like, you can charge more than you think you can. Like, your time is valuable, even though like no one's paid you in the past, maybe like your time is actually very valuable. So,
yeah. You think there's a crypto angle here at all? Or just randomly thinking, because you've done a lot of work in cryptocurrencies as well.
Yeah, I think crypto. I really am very interested in crypto because I see it as like offering new primitives for how to trust each other. Without having, you know, everyone talks about like not having to have a centralized source of truth. And I think like that's just like has to be valuable. Like it just seems like so, so important. I haven't really seen any applications to me yet that besides like the cryptocurrencies themselves, like the Bitcoins and Ethereums of the world where that has like really supercharged anything. But to be honest, I would be surprised if in 10 years we didn't have some like really important use case of that. I just don't know what it is. I think also related to that, like a concept that is really, really interesting about cryptocurrency is that as the network gets more valuable, the holders of the coins become better off. I think of crypto tokens as very similar to like land in a city. So if you, let's say you like 10 people move to an empty plot of land and they start improving it, they create a community there, people move there, more people start buying land, the price of the land goes up. Like because they were the first movers and they like made a bet early and started investing in that place, now suddenly they're benefiting from like those rising land prices. I think crypto does the same thing. And so I think the key question is, how do you tie the token to like other, like how do you tie the token to the value that's created by the open source software? Yeah. How do you create that linkage? And I think if someone answers that question, then tokens will just like be incredibly powerful as a way to, you know, invest and bring value back to the people who've invested in that network. So, but I don't, so I see like a hazy shape, but I don't know what the thing is to build to make that happen. But I see like the pieces and I just don't quite know how they connect.
Interesting. Okay. Real quick. I've already kept you over time. Can you quickly share like what you're up to next, after GitHub?
Yeah. Right now. So I left GitHub like 4 months ago and I've been taking that time to just do deep research on things that I've always found interesting and go down different paths. And something I've been thinking a lot about, which is sort of related to the research I've been doing about like labor and business regulations in Central America, is mm-hmm. like I've spent a fair bit of time in Argentina in particular, which is not in Central America, it's in South America, but mm-hmm. also in Panama. And I have just like this like very deep feeling that like Latin America is filled with brilliant people who are held back by really poorly designed systems. Mm. And I want to figure out what the levers are for helping those people get to better systems that enable them to do the work that they want to do and create the value they want to create for the world. And like, to be very concrete about it, like in Argentina, there's immense fluctuation in the value of the currency, which like takes up a lot of the brain space of ambitious young Argentinians. That's a whole conversation in of itself, but like, basically when I go down to Buenos Aires, I go there once a year because my boyfriend's family is from there. Mm-hmm. I feel like half of the conversations I have with people are about just like how to like optimize their life so that they like have like their savings don't go to zero when inflation happens, which is just like tragic to me because these people are really, really smart and like can do a lot. So anyway, like just, I've been thinking like, what can you do? I don't have any ideas for how to reform like the Argentinian government. And I also don't really know how to like fix like labor law in Honduras, but I've been thinking like, could you create like alternatives where those people like little zones where people could go that have better policies or more stable policies at least. And I don't have the answer to that yet, but I'm going down that path and looking for answers. So if anyone has the answer, let me know, because I want to build it.
Awesome. My guest today has been Devin Zugel. Devin, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Super fun.
The Sourcegraph podcast is a production of Sourcegraph, the universal code search engine, which gives you fast and expressive search over the world of code you care about. Sourcegraph also provides code navigation abilities like jump to def and references in code review, and integrates seamlessly with your code host, whether you're working in open source or on a big, hairy enterprise code base. To learn more, visit sourcegraph.com. See you next time.